So, good morning, welcome everyone to our third session in the Living Word series this week. For those of you just joining us for the first time, my name is Anthony Batiza. I'm a professor at St. Olaf College, which it says up there, in Northfield, Minnesota. I teach in the religion department with a specialty in Martin Luther Research and Ethics. My mother-in-law always says before a trip, I apologize for all the things I've forgotten. Get in the car, we'll leave. Sorry. Blanket apology. I teach at St. Olaf College in the religion department. I focus on Luther, but I also do some work with critical race theory, race and racism, identity in my classes, and so you're getting kind of a smorgasbord of my interests for this week. So I'll do a little bit of a recap, and we'll get into today's subject. Yeah. You don't need Bibles today, for those of you who are repeat questions. So, extra bonus points in heaven, if you grab one on the way in. We will be using them again tomorrow, though, so don't get confused. Today we're not. But today we're doing this a little bit differently. I have some slides. They're going to do a lot more, actually, reading a text together. Instead of having me cut and chop King's Letter from Birmingham Jail, there's some copies. And you're going to sit together and read through it together and do what my students do, which is read text closely. So, there you go. All right. So we're going to do this. So, again, just to kind of put things in perspective, the first couple of days we were digging into Christian theological resources and biblical resources, using folks like Thomas Aquinas, Martin Luther, and some passages from the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. And the second half of the week here, we're shifting to some different texts. No Bible today. Today we have Martin Luther King Jr. And his talk about the white moderate in his letter from Birmingham Jail. Tomorrow we're going to have some selections from James Baldwin, primarily The Fire Next Time. And then a more contemporary author, a guy who's still alive and writing, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who writes for The Atlantic on occasion. Has some articles in the New York Times, and also is writing now comic books. He wrote a series of Black Panther comics last year, and he's doing Captain America this year. So, it's exciting, right? Great, challenging authors also doing comic books. It's like a nerd's dream come true. Okay. So, again, just to recap, folks who are joining us today, or folks who need a refresher from the last couple of days. We spoke a little bit yesterday about Martin Luther's approach to fear, suffering, and angst in the Christian life. And I tried to say that Luther, drawing on his own experiences and his own challenges, drawing on mystical writings in the German vernacular, really has this deep sense that the Christian life isn't one that avoids suffering, but the Christian life is one that brings suffering. The closer you are to following Christ, to hearing Christ, to really living out Christ's gospel, the more the devil hates that. Right? And the devil's going to come at you and come at you hard. And if you're not being challenged, if you're not struggling, if there aren't things that make you fearful and anxious, then you probably aren't following Jesus, Luther thinks. Okay? And so Luther doesn't want Christians to sort of soak and simmer in this fear and anxiety, in this Angstbefühl. But he wants them to never let go of it. Right? So he wants them to hold on to and recognize how these fears and anxieties are going to come at you, but also still hold on to God's promises and do both of those simultaneously. Right? Easier said than done. And so Luther recommended that we do this together. That you're not going to be able to hold these together without the help of friends, the help of a good stiff drink, and a community to support you. And they also have drinks. So we also talked a little bit about Thomas Aquinas yesterday. We've been building on the video of Thomas the first day, where Thomas is talking about fear as a passion, something natural that comes from the fears we have about losing the things we love. And Thomas thinks that the proper response then to fear getting out of shape or getting excessive is to cultivate the virtue of courage. So courage involves pressing on in the face of fear, not the removal of fear, for Thomas. Right? Fear is natural. You have to have fear. No fear means no love. What you need then is courage, fortitude, to keep going when fear would cause you to contract, to restrict, to sort of pull in on yourself. Okay. So Thomas laid out for us just very briefly some of the ways that Thomas categorizes and pairs different virtues and vices. right? Courage is a virtue, whereas fear, in the excessive vice sense, or fearlessness, not being afraid enough, are vices. And there are certain other excesses that can arise. If you're too, you have too much courage, we might say, if you're too confident, you might say, you can also lean into the realm of presumption and vainglory. Having gone through many years of graduate training, I encountered many people in my classrooms, and I'm sure people would say that would be sometimes when you're in a graduate setting. You sort of get puffed up sometimes, you're kind of, you know, everyone's posturing. It's like, well, actually, in this one letter from 1527, says this, you haven't read, and therefore I am fabulous. Subtext. That's always a subtext. So there's often this temptation, right, to again, confidence gone too far. Leads to presumption and vainglory or vanity. Confidence that is too lacking, right? I said you leads to pusillanimity, hard to say. We might think of this as excessive shyness or weakness of soul or spirit. Not able to actually hear that you're capable of doing things, not being able to receive confidently the compliments people give you. Right? And all of these are going to be a problem. You're afraid of hearing good things about yourself and afraid of believing you can actually do something. So when I ended then, I said Thomas leaves us with a different example of what courage looks like than a lot of his Greek philosophical predecessors. Thomas leaves us with the image of the martyr as being the exemplar of courage, bar none, versus the soldier in battle. And he talked about martyrdom, as I said, as standing firmly to truth and justice against the assaults of persecution. So you can think of this in strictly Christian terms and say martyrdom is standing up for the faith in the face of the persecution of the faith. But I love the way Thomas talks about it, again, standing up for truth and justice, which just sounds more expansive, but for Thomas it would be the same thing. Like I said yesterday, if you're standing up for truth, if you're standing up for justice, God is truth, God is justice, and so you are being a Christian martyr when you stand on the side of justice. Even though you're not explicitly, you know, trumpeting your interpretation of the communion doctrines or things like that. Different vision of martyrdom. Okay. So then I end this with a couple of questions, a couple of statements and questions. So Thomas and Luther are both encouraging us to accept our fears, to recognize that fear is okay, natural and important, but also to keep trusting and fighting in the midst of those fears. Right? To not think we can be rid of our fears, but to not give up in the face of them. So I wanted us to think about, in the second half of our week, today, tomorrow, and Friday, what Christian martyrdom might look like today for us who are living not in the 16th century, not in the 13th century, but here in the United States and the world more broadly today. So to do that, we're going to talk about three figures that I have selected. And we're going to start today with Martin Luther King Jr. Now, everybody knows about Martin Luther King Jr., I hope. If not, I need to talk to your high school principal, your elementary school teacher. Something's gone horribly wrong. But I don't know anymore. I was telling a group soon after the election in 2016, there were a lot of things I took for granted, I think. I took for granted that we care for refugees. That was just sort of like a part of the American sense of even our own sort of pride in ourselves. Like, we have lots of money, lots of resources. We take care of refugees. Like, that's low-hanging fruit. We've got to push for higher goals. And I'm like, oh, apparently not. Apparently I was way off. And what I thought was, you know, taken for granted no longer is. But, so, hopefully you all have heard of Martin Luther King Jr. King was born in 1929 in Atlanta, Georgia, son of a Baptist preacher. You might remember or have learned, he actually may or may not have been born Martin Luther King. There's a sort of funny apocryphal stuff about his original birth certificate, I think, said Michael King. And his father's name was Michael King. And then later, like by the time Mike Martin was three, he had his birth certificate changed to be Martin Luther. I always feel affinity for that for some reason. The stories that were given, the dad said the name was wrong originally, but that was actually his name. So it was just sort of his dad was just kind of conversion experience, or some kind of experience where he felt closer to Luther in some way and wanted to bring that into his own name and give his son the same name. So very interesting. So, in 1955, at the ripe age of 26, I think about what I was doing at 27 and what King was doing at 26. It's an exercise in humility. But King was sort of thrust into being one of the main leaders, the main spokespersons in the Montgomery bus boycott. And it was not a position he initially sought out. Again, he was trained to be a preacher. He went off to Boston to get a PhD. He was a kind of middle class kind of guy, a kind of preacher. Was committed to the cause of justice, but didn't know in these early stages that this was the path he was going to be on. This is what he was called to do. Didn't know that the bus boycott was going to explode the way that it did and lead him down paths that it did. So he always had a passion for justice, but he didn't know where his life was going to go. He just kind of stepped into the moment and was pushed and encouraged by others to take up this leadership role because he was a smooth talker, a wonderful orator, a deep thinker, and they're like, we want you in front. So after the success in Montgomery, he helped found and lead the Southern Christian Leadership Conference from 57 to 68, at which point, as you all know, he was assassinated. Right. So if you think about it, King's career was 13 years. At least his career as a civil rights leader. Right? 13 years. He accomplished all that he did, helping lobby for the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, anti-poverty efforts in the Poor People's Campaign, against the war in Vietnam, against U.S. empire building around the world. Did all of this in 13 years. Okay? So again, gives us pause, I think, to reevaluate how we're using our time. At least it does me. So, getting us to our text for today, after some successful campaigns, I've mentioned Montgomery already, and some that were not so successful, there was a campaign in Albany, Georgia, that went on for many months and ended up being kind of a failure that never really got any traction. King was rather embarrassed by it. He's still trying to get his footing and establish his place, but then by 1963, he's invited to be a part of desegregation efforts in Birmingham, known as one of the most segregated cities in America. At that point, efforts had already been underway to try and engage in disruptive action and direct action to end segregation practices in Birmingham. But they actually hadn't been working very well. The local organizers weren't getting a lot of attention. They weren't getting a lot of traction. Politicians weren't responding. It was sort of stagnant, they felt. So then the folks on the ground decided to make some changes to their tactics, and then also invited King and the SCLC to come help them. And they made some interesting changes to the tactics, and I'll circle back to this at the end today. But one thing is they became more aggressive. Right? They wanted to openly disrupt life, larger sit-ins, larger disruptions of businesses, larger disruptions of civic life, marching without permits, openly violating loitering and organizing laws. Right? They were going to actively break the laws that they believed were unjust. The more controversial move they made, at least initially, was the second one I have here. Right? The inclusion of children and young people in these efforts. Right? A lot of times it was felt that since these efforts could be dangerous, you could be arrested, and in Birmingham, you know, water hoses were brought out, German shepherds were brought out, that you needed to leave kids at home, and this was a work for grown adults and mature folks to put themselves out there. But the organizers felt that the people needed to see the children and their faces before them, kind of see the children who are being affected. But that would have a big impact in terms of how the world viewed what was happening there. And also that this was an instructional moment for the children themselves. And that the issues were so serious, that the needs were so great, that the children needed to be brought into this way of seeing the world, this way of being committed to organized disruptive action, direct action. Okay. As you, of course, know, many of these protesters, many sort of young folks, teenagers here on the left, and even younger, before the local sheriff, German shepherds I mentioned earlier there on the right. But it was images like these that started to spur greater attention to what was going on in Birmingham. Right? Images of sort of blatant police brutality in the face of young, innocent faces standing up against them. So King goes to Birmingham. He ends up getting arrested while he's there, locked away in Birmingham jail. And while he's in jail, a letter is published by some other Christian clergy. So on April 12, 63, 8 respected clergy persons, all of them Protestant except for one, there was one prominent rabbi who wrote. There's a couple Roman Catholic bishops, there's a Methodist, a Presbyterian. There's no Lutherans in the list that I'm aware of, probably because there weren't as many Lutherans in the area. So I don't think it's like a pat on the back of Lutherans. They just weren't there to put their name on this document. And in this document, these pastors and this one rabbi made it somewhat clear that they agreed that segregation was a problem, that injustice was going on in Birmingham. But they were very critical of the timing and the methods being taken by King and others. Like, we agree with, you know, what you're saying, we just don't like the way you're saying it, and we don't like the people who are saying it. How does this look like? I'll just give you some snippets from them. In the letter, the pastors and rabbis said, "We are now confronted by a series of demonstrations by some of our Negro citizens, directed and led in part by outsiders." Folks like King. They went on to say later in the letter, "We believe this kind of facing of issues can best be accomplished by citizens of our own metropolitan area, white and Negro, meeting with their knowledge and experience of the local situation."
Right.
It's a very subtle, right? Very subtle sort of criticism. No, we're totally with you, but we just want to handle this ourselves. We understand the situation better. You're interlopers, right? You're being brought in by buses to protest. We got to keep you folks at bay. What else did they say? They say, "We recognize the natural impatience of people who feel that their hopes are slow in being realized, but we are convinced that these demonstrations are unwise and untimely." Okay. We hear you. We understand why you're not, you know, being patient. Impatience makes sense, but ... Not the wisest, not really a great time for us right now. Okay. So they want to say, "All of us need to face that responsibility and find proper channels for its accomplishment." What they ended up saying, "This is, we formally pointed out that hatred and violence have no sanction in our religious and political tradition. We also point out that such actions as incite to hatred and violence, however technically peaceful those actions may be, have not contributed to the resolution of our local problems. We do not believe that these days of new hope are days when extreme measures are justified in Birmingham." Notice, however technically peaceful those actions may be, right? They're trying to say, "Listen, King, we know you're peaceful. We know you all are talking about nonviolence, but violence is happening. It's probably your fault, right? The dogs, the water hoses, the bricks being thrown at you—it's probably on you, right? Because of the way you're going about these things. You're breaking the law. Right? You're doing things that are clearly the rule books say you can't do." Christians don't incite violence or hatred. They're peaceful people, and it doesn't look peaceful. You see the dogs, you see the hoses. This isn't working for us. Okay? I've never done a deep dive or a study. I have maybe a free year or something. I'm really curious to know what happened to those pastors and that rabbi. I've never looked it up. On me one of these days to dig around and find that out. But I just have this lingering curiosity of, like, how did their lives end up? Like, how did their ministries go in the years and decades that followed? If you know, tell me afterwards. Tell me where to look. Alright. So, 4 days later, or the next 4 days or so, King receives this letter. It's in the newspaper. It's published in a variety of local newspapers. And then King begins to write his response by scribbling in on little scraps of paper and in the margins of newspapers and slipping out with his lawyer, and they had to smuggle it away, trying to figure out how to reassemble it because they didn't write page numbers or anything. So they tried to reconnect it. And then it was released, published in a variety of places, the New York Post, the Christian Century, the Atlantic published a version a few months later, and it sort of caught fire after that. The letter circled and swept all over the place. So, you may have read it before, but now you're going to read it again. So, no harm in that. So I have 25 copies, because we're at Holden and we're trying to be good conservationists. So I want folks to share if you can. So pair up, two, maybe even three, if you're comfortable with that. But text is kind of small. Again, I was trying to make shade paper. So it's tiny, smallish font. So the one of you who has the strongest eyes might want to hold it closer to one who has weaker eyes. Just kind of say that as gently as I can. All right, so pair up. We're going to take about 10, 15 minutes and just read through it. Right, read through it together. Okay. After that time, I'm going to put some questions on the board and have some conversation about what you've read. Okay? I was just talking to people as they were coming in. I realized I actually could have given this to you yesterday, and I should take it home to read it. That was a thought that Tuesday Anthony didn't have. And now Wednesday Anthony is mad at him. So, there you go. So, before I get to my questions, let's start with just your general impressions. What about the letter caught your attention or your group's attention as you were reading through it either silently or aloud?
We really noticed, you know, there's lots of little quotes that we've heard, but we never had the context.
Yes.
So it was really nice to have that, all that context.
Yes, that's perfect. Yeah, unfortunately, because of Kane's popularity, he gets turned easily into, like, quotes or snippets that fit on, like, memes on the internet or on mugs or on t-shirts. Right? No, honestly, he just, like, gets this sanitized, bite-sized version of Kane. You don't really get a sense of, oh, that's what that quote is, and, like, this is the context that it fits into. Excellent. Others, yeah.
I'm in northern Minnesota, Bemidji, and we're in the middle of three Indian reservations, and there was a strong boycotting of the Native American people shopping in Bemidji. And I'd like to know what years that happened, because we moved there in 84, and that's in direct correlation to what he was doing here.
Yeah. So I wonder, 20 years later, they're still drawing on, are they affected by his techniques?
Mm-hmm. Are they still doing that? Was that back then?
I would like to know what years they were doing that, because the rumbles of that still continue, and the need for it still continues.
So the boycott isn't still active, but the conditions it was addressing are still real.
Yeah.
I think it's very personal, and it gives firsthand personal experiences, which I think are really very moving.
So he flies with some high sort of technical details about how he organizes, about how the organization works. He drops in some theology and some biblical allusions here and there, but also takes it down to this sort of existential, heart, personal. Perfect. Let's go to the back.
He's calling out and sort of disappointment in white moderates.
Yeah.
That's a great word for it. Disappointment.
Yeah, apropos what you just said a minute ago, he has all of this at his command. I mean, he's sitting there writing this without books. I mean, he's deeply, I mean, he's brilliant. I mean, he has biblical, theological, philosophical, the whole, you know, thing about legal and, I mean, all of that is part of his understanding of who he is, and it's, you know, it's really impressive.
So, can I stick with that for 1 second? It gets to my first question. I do that. So, what biblical and theological sources did you notice King drawing from?
Niebuhr, Tillich.
Okay.
Aquinas.
What's that?
Aquinas.
Look at that. Like somebody's been in these things. Right. Augustine. Titus. Thomas Aquinas. Saint Augustine.
Martin Buber.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Socrates.
Yeah. Well, and U.S. history and understanding of sort of law and constitution and
yes, it's a democratic values and ideals.
He drew on some biblical things too, Shadrach, Meshach.
Yes, yeah. And there was a little allusion to.
I was just gonna say, I don't know how intentional it was, as suspect it was, but he is seems to be very specifically not calling on any Black voices in theological history, like almost using some of their own respected voices in that Black community to push them.
Yeah, kind of using their own tools against them.
Yeah.
Right. They may not recognize a sort of Black slave religion, the African American experience, and folks right now that experience as having authority. But it's kind of hard for the Catholic bishop to ignore Thomas Aquinas, right, or the rabbi to ignore Buber, right? It's like, well, there's a little allusion there early on to those 8th century prophets.
Yeah.
Any idea who those might be?
Amos.
Isaiah.
Right. So again, you're thinking about, gee, we don't. What kind of resources do we have to call out injustice in our world and call out racism? King says, well, you have it, you've had them right in front of you the whole time, right? I'm looking for the great new book that's going to talk about how to be prophetic.
Yeah.
Well, there's this guy, Amos, right? About 2,700 years ago, so it's hot off the presses, right? Maybe you should go back and check that out again. Just, you know, suggestion. Okay? Can we think for a second about the white moderate, right? We have these eight clergy persons as an example. What do you get a sense in King's writing? What is the white moderate afraid of?
Change.
Disruption.
Violence. Breaking the law.
What's that?
Breaking the law.
Breaking the law.
Violence.
Control. Yep.
What's that?
Losing control.
Losing control.
Disorder.
Disorder.
Mm-hmm. Loss is privilege.
Okay. Privilege, order, control.
Status.
Status.
Power. Money.
Money.
Rebuke.
What was that?
Rebuke.
Rebuke. Okay. Afraid of being called out. Rebuked.
Mm-hmm. I wonder about. I mean, I was just thinking about right now too. Like, is there a fear of backlash? Like, the racist will come harder.
Yeah. Could be.
Change of social order.
Okay.
All the stuff about being bad because if Luther run with his right, then he has been morally unjust for a long time, and so that should make them feel bad about him.
Yeah. Yeah, the punishment's gonna come for these years of injustice.
If those guys arrive, I'm gonna be back.
Excellent.
Some are worried about being considered sympathizers.
Sympathizers. What's that mean?
Well, I don't really want to fix the bottom page. Or, you know, unlike many of their modern brothers, we recognize the urgency at the moment, you know. Suffering groups and brutality of any race placed in the seat in that dirty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Careful with using the word. But yeah. So there are all these fears the white moderate is holding on to. Are you a white moderate? No, most. I'm assuming most of you are white. Assumptions should be corrected. Challenged, but. Do you have some of those same fears?
Yeah, I think part of what he was addressing is I think there was and is a lot of the population that we don't want to look at ourselves as part of the problem. I'm not a racist. I don't believe in this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even believe in the segregation. So, you know, I'm not the problem. You know, the problem is somebody else. And so I think that's part of what he's addressing is having it. And nobody wants to look at ourselves and say, I'm part of the problem. It's hard.
I should have a slide on this. So there's a book by a sociologist named Eduardo Bonilla Silva. It's wonderful. You should all read it at your leisure. It's called Racism Without Racists. It talks about the new era of colorblind racism in America. He was writing particularly after the Obama election, but has re-released it in the years since. The idea being that the kind of fire hose and German Shepherd vision of racism is less now than it was in King's time. That's a fair statement to say. Still going on, but less than. So what kind of shape is racism taking? It's the colorblind racist. It's the racist who says, I'm not one of those guys carrying tiki torches in Charlottesville, therefore I'm not a part of the problem. It's the racism of the white moderate. See, you haven't spoken yet.
I'm just saying when was it Philando Castile that was killed by the police in Minneapolis?
Yep.
And there were protests, Black Lives Matter was there, and they were out in the interstate highway in the Twin Cities. I had people that said to me, why do they need to do it there? That inconveniences people. And I just said to them, because what good is a protest if it's done out of sight? And maybe the same thing with the national anthem protest at the NFL games.
Right. So it needs to be visible, it needs to be disruptive, it needs to be uncomfortable in some way.
Yeah.
And there's even a problem sometimes now of institutions trying to support these disruptions, which sort of robs them of their strength.
Yeah.
So for example, there was a protest at my own college, St. Olaf College, a couple of years ago, related to institutional racism and issues in America, two springs ago. The students staged a walkout class, wanted students to join them. Then the provost canceled classes. And the provost saw that as a way of like, you know, recognizing the movement and trying to empower it. And the students were like, no, you just have robbed it of any actual cost. Right? Now people, you know, now a third of the students come out to protest, and a third of them are probably stay home and think now we have a free day. And there isn't that sort of tension in the classroom of it being, you know, there being four or five kids there.
Right.
And they care what to do about that. Right? So the disruption is important. We need to be shaken up, made afraid, made aware. Sorry, there were other hands.
Okay, yeah, just back to what you were saying about, I think the white moderates, especially those leaders that wrote that, you know, the original, I mean, they want to be the leaders of change in their way. I mean, and I think that's one of the dilemmas of white moderates is that they don't, you know, they fear the leadership by others. They would rather, you know, we want to be in charge of how this change happens. And I think that's a real issue today. I mean,
absolutely.
Established leadership, wanting to sort of set the rules, the
exactly.
parameters, be in charge, and then not knowing what to do with kind of grassroots or
exactly.
other explosions of energy or change. Yeah.
Coming back to this, what is racism and who is a racist? There was a long, or still is, I believe, in the German Times, a series on that, and one part that shocked me was that one of the authors who wrote it considered himself a real liberal, and then he said, oh, by God, but I'm a racist dater, because all this internet dating, if you like, look at it, statistically, he had a lot of hits of women of color, but he never dated one, so there is like hidden racism that we don't consciously have. It's like in all minority treatments, also against women, that you don't realize that you do that, but the people who are like on the other side, they feel it because you never say hello to them or do things like this. And I think that's the hardest part of it, that you consider yourself to be liberal and then you face it and say, gosh, in this action, or maybe just saying because I, like sometimes you feel good because you have friends of color, and then they, just this thought alone is racist because it doesn't matter, right? So, and that's making it so hard for us, I think, because you try, and then in just trying, you already have the bias again, because actually it should not matter at all. We should not actually be like kids. If you ask kids, okay, find common things. Very often, when they're really little, they will never mention skin color. They don't say, I love vanilla ice cream and you love chocolate ice cream.
Sure. Those are important differences for them.
Yeah. And that's how you realize how deep-rooted racism actually is. And that's making it so hard for us because we don't want to be it. And then we get caught in it after all because somehow in society, as a whole, that has this way of
happening. I'm going to follow up on that and say a couple things and then try and wrap this up. I'm mindful of time. I know there's a lot of questions out there, a lot of hands, so I don't want to cut anybody off. But just following up on this, right? Implicit bias is the word that gets hopped around a lot, this kind of tendency. The racism is sort of the prejudice that's unintentional, involuntary, unnoticed, just because of the systems and structures that we're all soaking in. And that's one of the reasons why I love King's letter, right, is we often see him pitted in this battle against the police officers, the folks who arrested him, the fire hoses, and the German shepherds. And he says here that he's more troubled, right, more disturbed, more disheartened, not by those folks. Right? Those are pretty clear who they are, what they're about. At least everything's out in the open.
Yeah.
It's 60% in the middle that want to sort of stay in the middle,
yeah,
and not risk anything, or not lose control of how this change is going to happen. Okay. Two other little things from the letter I hope you picked up on. Step two. So first off, you notice, I'm going to take this with what the rabbi said last night during our Vespers time, right? The great line about the one garment of destiny, right? How we all are woven together, justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. The king has this very deep sense that we can't just think of this as one group's problem versus our problems, and all of our problems and all of our solutions are going to be intertwined, interconnected. And he has this great line, right, where he says, in America, there can be no outsider.
Yes.
Right, you know what that means. That if you are in living in Washington, let's say randomly, or Minnesota, that gets like half the crowd of me. If you're living in Washington or Minnesota, right, then what's going on in Ferguson, what's going on in Ohio, what's going on in Oakland, those are all still your problems. And your congregation can be as white as rice and a glass of milk on a snowy day, but again, shooting dark here, but dark outside out there. But the issues facing people of color, black folks, brown folks in this country are just as much your issues. Not that you take control over how you can resolve, but to see their pains as your pains, their sufferings as yours. And if you don't, right, if you're not afraid and concerned for people of color, following Thomas's logic, it means you don't love them. Following King's logic, that means you're not connected to them. And we would say both those things are false, I think, in our better moments. Second thing, this is also related to what somebody said earlier about sort of the visceral sense of King's writing. Right? I don't know of anybody who has a child or knows a child who can read his description of talking to his daughter.
No.
Right? About her inability to go to Funtown. Right? The black girls aren't welcome in Funtown. Right. Who can read that and not feel it in their guts, in their bones? So again, the ability to make good arguments is important, but the ability to reach people in a real human, experiential way, to let them see what the suffering actually feels like, and to recognize that suffering, you know, still going on. That there are little black boys and little black girls who still feel like they can't go to certain schools, they can't get access to certain jobs, they can't go to certain colleges. There's a lot of sundown towns still around. When I was coming out here, my family and I drove from Minnesota. One of my friends, while I was stopping to visit, said, maybe don't stop in Coeur d'Alene. And my image of Coeur d'Alene, like, I think they have like an Iron Man there. I'm like, oh yeah, it's like beautiful and there's mountains and people just run around and it's happy. Like, no, a friend of mine who was a black pastor, got punched in a McDonald's.
Wow, come on.
So just, you know, maybe don't stop there. And so again, to recognize that there's for a lot of black and brown bodies, there are still places, are many places that are still fun. Okay? I have a couple more slides coming in. Okay, and I'll let you all go. Coffee shop is still open, so you still have time. Another tech recommendation I'm just going to toss out here in quick passing. There's a philosopher named Danielle Allen. She teaches at Harvard now. I think she's all at Harvard. She wrote a book maybe 7-9 years ago called Talking to Strangers, in which she's talking about democracy and race. And she uses as her case example the efforts of segregation, particularly this picture of Elizabeth Eckford, the young woman in the front, so the white, and Hazel Barnes, the white woman, Hazel something, in the dress, sort of spitting and yelling at her behind, right? To say that this picture helped solidify the civil rights movement or get awareness for the civil rights movement and desegregation, because it put on display for people, made people see what people were experiencing, how they were acting, how they were behaving. And made people see sort of the calm, stoic presence of this young black woman versus the pure hatred in the face of this white woman behind her. And she says, it makes us recognize that in our society, in any democratic society, there will always be sacrifices, but we fail to miss how those sacrifices are being borne unequally. Mm. How those sacrifices, those burdens, those challenges are being shouldered by certain people, particularly poor and black folks, more than they are by other folks. So, my last little point for you all today, then, as you go back, you're thinking about going back into regular life down the mountain, that sort of thing. Is to what extent is the community you're a part of, right, the church, wherever you find yourself, is it confronting you with images like this from today? Right? To what extent is your leadership, are your pastors, or are your elders, or the folks in your congregation talking about Black Lives Matter? Not that they need to be wearing a Black Lives Matter button and leading everyone to rallies, that's not where everybody's going to be. But if they're not naming it and talking about it and creating a space for the conversation, that's a problem. Okay? To what extent are these young boys named in your congregation? Quick quiz. Who knows who those boys are? Trayvon Martin and?
Tamir Rice.
Tamir Rice was a young boy in Ohio who was playing in a playground with a toy gun. A police officer pulled up 3 to 6 seconds afterwards, shot him. Killed him. He was 12 years old.
Toy gun.
Somebody called 911, said, I think it's a toy, but there's some kid running around. And then the cop shot him. A cop who had been dismissed from a previous job for poor performance and excessive violence and things. So
that was the standard. Stand your ground thing, wasn't it?
Trayvon. Trayvon on the left was stand your ground, killed by George Zimmerman carrying a can of Arizona iced tea and a bag of Skittles. And that was based on the stand your ground laws in Florida. Tamir was just a kid playing in a playground in Ohio in the afternoon. Yeah. So, again, if our congregations aren't willing to name these names, to show their faces, to confront these pictures, they're probably afraid. Probably afraid for a lot of reasons we might say are excessive or misshapen or deformations of fear. And so I hope that you have the courage to say their names, to recognize their situation, to read King's text anew, and I hope to see you all back here tomorrow. Thank you.